Part 2. The Second March. Chapter 9. Hinnereth. One can look into the future, or one can look at the future. The latter is by far the more instructive. Agensis, the third analytic of men. If one doubts that passion and unreason govern the fate of nations, one need only look to meetings between the great. Kings and emperors are unused to treating with equals and are often excessively relieved or repelled as a result. The Nilnameshi have a saying, when princes meet, they find either brothers or themselves, which is to say, either peace or war. Drusus Acamian, The Compendium of the First Holy War. Early Summer, 4111, Year of the Tusk, Momum. Song and myriad glittering torches greeted Icuri Zarius III as he passed through curtains of wispy linen and into the palatial courtyard. Only in light must the emperor be seen. There was a rustle of fabric as the throngs fell to their knees and pressed their powdered faces against the lawns. Only the tall Eothic guardsman remained standing. With child slaves holding the hem of his gown, Zarius walked among the prostrated forms and savored, as he always did, this loneliness, this godlike loneliness.
He summons me! Me! The insolence!
He mounted the wooden steps and climbed into the imperial chariot. A call was given for all to rise. Zarius held out his white-gloved hand, idly wondering whom Ingaro, his grand seneschal, had chosen to hand him the reins, an honor of great traditional significance, but beneath the emperor's practical notice. Zarius trusted the judgment of his grand seneschal implicitly, as he'd once trusted Scaeus. A pang of horror. How long would that name cut like glass? Scaeus. He barely noticed the boy who handed him the reins. Some young scion of House Kiskei? No matter. Zarius was typically graceful even when distracted, a trait inherited from his father. His father might have been a craven fool, but oh, how he'd always looked, the great emperor. Zarius passed the reins to his charioteer and numbly signaled the advance. The team started at the snap of the captain's whip, then began prancing forward, drawing the gold-paneled chariot behind them. The censers affixed to the runners rattled, trailing streamers of blue incense, jasmine, and sweet sandalwood. The emperor must be spared the disconcerting smells of his capital. Observed by hundreds of painted and ingratiating faces, Zarius stared firmly forward, his stance statuary, his look remote and haughty. Only a select few received the nod of imperial acknowledgement. His bitch-mother, Astraea, old General Cumulaeus, whose support had assured him the mantle after his father's death, and of course his favorite augur, Arithmaeus. The intangible gold of imperial favor was something Zarius hoarded jealously, and he was shrewd in its dispensation. Daring may be required to make the climb, but thrift was ever the key to holding the summit. Another lesson Zarius had learned from his mother. The empress had steeped him in the bloody history of his predecessors, tutored him with endless examples of past disaster. This one too trusting, that one too cruel, and so on. Sermonte Scylura II, who'd kept a bowl of molten gold at his side to fling at those who displeased him, had been too cruel. Sermontes Atancius, on the other hand, had been too martial. Conquest should enrich, not bankrupt. Xerxes Triamarius III had been too fat, so fat he needed slaves to brace his knees when he rode his horse. His death, Astraea had chortled, had been as much a matter of aesthetic decency as anything else. An emperor must look a god, not an overstuffed eunuch. Too much of this and too much of that.
The world doesn't constrain us,
the indomitable empress had once explained, batting her harlot eyes.
So we must constrain ourselves, like the gods. Discipline, sweet Zarius. We must have discipline.
Something he possessed in abundance, or so Zarius thought. Outside the courtyard, files of heavy cavalrymen, elite Kidrahil, positioned themselves before and after the imperial chariot, and flanked by running torchbearers, the shining procession wound down the Andiamine Heights toward the dark and smoky troughs of Momim. Moving slowly so the torchbearers could keep pace, it clattered through the imperial precincts and onto the long monumental avenue that joined the palace compounds to the temple complex of Kamiral. Numerous Momimites stood in shadowy clots along the avenue, straining for a glimpse of their divine emperor. Obviously, word of his short pilgrimage had spread throughout the city. Turning left and right, Zariah smiled and raised his hand in salute after leisurely salute. So he wants this to be public. At first, he could see little beyond the runners and their glittering torches, nor could he hear much over the sound of hooves clapping across cobble. The farther they traveled, however, the more congested the processional avenue became. Soon, slaves and caste menials jostled within spitting distance of the torchbearers, their faces clearly illuminated, and Zarius realized that they actually jeered and laughed each time he saluted them. For a moment, he feared his heart might stop. He clutched the shuddering runners to steady himself. That he could make such a fool of himself. Despite the streaming censers, the air took on the distinct odor of shit. Within moments, it seemed, hundreds had become thousands, and as their numbers grew, so did their gall. Soon the air shivered with the thunder of multitudes. Horrified, Zarius watched the torchlight sort through face after unwashed face, each turned to him, some watching in silent accusation or contempt, some sneering, others shouting or howling in spittle-flecked rage. The procession trundled on, as yet unimpeded, but the sense of bristling pageantry had evaporated. Zariah swallowed. Cold sweat snaked between his clothes and skin. He turned his eyes resolutely forward to the stiff backs of his cavalrymen. This is what he wants, he told himself. Remember, be disciplined. Officers bawled urgent commands. The Kidrahil drew their clubs. The procession found brief respite crossing the bridge over the Rat Canal. Zariah saw pleasure barges anchored in the black waters, drifting in torch-illumined fogs of incense. Rising from their cushions, caste merchants and concubines lifted clay wafers, blessing tablets to be broken in his name. But their looks, Zariah could not help but notice, turned away long before his passage was complete, to the awaiting mobs. The unruly Momimites once again engulfed the procession. Women, the old and the infirm, even children, all shouting now, all brandishing fists. Glancing down, Zariah saw a poxed man rolling a rotted tooth on his tongue, which he spit as the imperial chariot passed. It fell somewhere beneath the wheels. They truly abhor me, Zariah realized. They hate me. Me! But this would change, he reminded himself. When all was finished, when the fruits of his labor had become manifest, they would hail him as no other emperor in living memory. They would rejoice as trains of heathen slaves bore tribute to the home city, as blinded kings were dragged in chains to their emperor's feet. And with shielded eyes they would gaze upon Icuri's Arius III, and they would know that he was indeed the Aspect Emperor, returned from the ashes of Kyrenius and Kinney to compel the world, to force nation and tribe to bow and kiss his knee. I will show them. They will see. The immense plaza of Kamiral opened before him, and the thunder of Momim's masses reached its crescendo, stealing his breath, numbing him with sound and implication. The forward Kidrahil halted, milled in momentary confusion. Zarius saw one cavalryman's horse rear. The Kidrahil who followed galloped ahead to secure the flanks. All flourished their clubs, waving them in warning, striking any who came too near. Beyond their small perimeter of gleaming armor and torchlight, the world was dark riot. Impoverished humanity, roaring fields of them, from the temple compounds to the left and right, to the great basalt pillars of Zathe ahead. Zarius clenched the chariot's forward rail until his knuckles whitened and his hands ached. All of them, over and over, crying that name. Dread, dizziness, and a sense of inner falling. Has he incited them against me? Is this to be an assassination? He watched as his Kidrahil clubbed first a sliver, then a wedge into the mobs. Suddenly he grinned, gritted his teeth in fierce pleasure. This was how the gods affirmed themselves, with the blood of mortals. The crowd surged against the forward Kidrahil, and the thunder seemed redoubled. Several shining horsemen stumbled and vanished. More horsemen rushed forward. Clubs rose and fell. Swords were drawn. The charioteer steadied his team, glancing nervously at him. "You look an emperor in the eye?"
"Go!" Zarius roared. "Into them, go!"
Laughing, he leaned from the runners and spat upon his people, upon those who cried another's name when Icuri Zarius III stood godlike in their midst. If only he could spit molten gold. Slowly, the chariot trundled ahead, lurching and throwing him forward as the wheels chipped over the fallen. His stomach burned with fear. His bowels felt loose. But there was a wildness in his thoughts, a delirium that exulted in death's proximity. One by one, the torchbearers were pulled under, but the Kidrahil stood fast, battling their way ever forward, hacking their way among the masses, their swords rising and falling, and it seemed to Zarius that he punished the mongrels with his arm, that it was he who reached forward and chopped them to the ground. Laughing maniacally, the emperor of Nansur passed among his people toward the growing immensity of Temple Zathe. Finally, the decimated procession reached the ranks of Eothic guardsmen arrayed across Zathe's monumental steps. Deafened, afflicted by the torpor of dreams, Zarius was guided from the chariot onto the raised wooden walkway that led to the temple's great gate. The emperor must always be seen standing above mere men. He viciously grabbed one of the captains by the arm.
"Send word to the barracks. Hack this place to silence. I want my chariot to skid across blood when I return."
Discipline. He would teach them. Then he strode toward Zathe's gate, stumbled for a moment on the hem of his gown, felt his heart stop beating for fury as laughter colored the ambient roar. He glanced for an instant across what seemed an ocean of anger and rapture. Then, gathering his gown, he very nearly fled up the walkway. The temple's massive stonework encompassed him. Shelter. The doors were ground shut behind him. His legs folded beneath him, a moment of hushed bewilderment, the cold floor against his knees. He placed a trembling hand to his forehead, was surprised by the sweat that ran between his fingers. Foolishness. What would Confis think? Ringing ears, airy darkness. Around him, that name shivered up from the stone. Mathanet. 1,000,000 voices, or so it seemed, crying like a prayer the name that Zarius spat as a curse. Mathanet. Feeling winded, he walked unsteadily across the antechamber, paused. Few of the great lamp wheels had been set alight. Pale circles of light were thrown across the vast temple floor, across the rows of faded prayer tile. Columns, as thick as Netia pine, soared into gloom. The hymnal galleries above were barely discernible in the dark. During times of official worship, this floor would billow with clouds of incense, making the temple's recesses vague and ghostly, smearing the points of lamplight with halos, so that it seemed to the faithful that they stood at the very juncture of this world and the outside. But now the place was cavernous and bare. Beneath the memory of myrrh, it smelled like a cellar. It was the juncture of nothing, only a pocket of peace purchased by dead stone. In the distance, Zarius could see him, kneeling in the center of the great hemisphere of idols. "There you are," he thought, feeling some solidity return to his hollow limbs. His slippers whispered as he walked across the floor. Unconsciously, his hands strayed across his vests and gown, smoothing, straightening. His eyes flitted across the friezes etched into the columns. Kings, emperors, and gods, all rigid with the supernatural dignity of figures in stone. He came to a stop before the first tier of stairs. The tallest center dome gaped above him. He stared for several moments at the shrier's broad back.
"Face your emperor, you fanatic ingrate." "I'm pleased you've come," Mathan had said with his back still turned to him. The voice was rich, enfolding. There was no deference in the tone.
Janann held Shrya and Emperor equal.
Why this, Mathanet? Why here?
The broad back turned. Mathanet was wearing a plain white frock with sleeves that ended mid-arm. For an instant, he appraised Zorias with glittering eyes. Then he raised his head to the distant sound of the mob, as though it were the sound of rain prayed for and received. Zorias could see the strong chin beneath the black of his oiled beard. His face was broad, like that of a yeoman, and surprisingly youthful, though nothing about the man's manner spoke of youth.
How old are you?
Listen, Mathanet hissed, raising his hands to the resonant sound of his name.
Mathanet, Mathanet, Mathanet. I am not a proud man, I Curie Zorias, but it moves me to hear them call thus.
Despite the foolish dramatics, Zorias found himself awed by the man's presence. The giddiness of moments before revisited his limbs.
I haven't the patience, Mathanet, for games of Janann.
The Shrya paused, then smiled winningly. He began walking down the steps.
I've come because of the holy war. I've come to look into your eyes.
These words further disconcerted the Emperor. Zorias had known, before coming here, that the stakes of this meeting could be high.
Tell me, Mathanet said, have you sealed a pact with the heathen? Have you vowed to betray the holy war before it reaches the sacred land?
Could he know? I assure you, Mathanet, no.
No?
I'm injured, Shrya, that you would—
Mathanet's laughter was sudden, loud, reverberant enough to fill even the hollows of Great Zothe. Zorias fairly gasped. The writ of Zata Antu, the code governing Shryal conduct, forbade laughing aloud as a carnal indulgence. Mathanet, he realized, was giving him a glimpse of his depths. But for what purpose? All of this, the mobs, the demand to meet here in Zothe, even the chanting of his name was a demonstration of some kind, terrifying in its premeditated lack of subtlety.
I'll crush you, Mathanet was saying. If the holy war fails, you'll be destroyed. Accept my apology, Emperor,
Mathanet said lightly.
It would seem that even a holy war may be poisoned by—
A pained smile.
False rumors.
Hmm?
He tries to cow me. He knows nothing, so he tries to cow me.
Zorias remained silent, wrathful. He'd always possessed, he thought, a greater facility for hatred than Confis. His precocious nephew could be vicious, savage even, but he inevitably slipped back into that glassy remoteness that so unnerved those in his company. For Zorias, hatred was something as enduring as it was implacable. Such a strange habit, he suddenly realized, these momentary inquiries into his nephew's nature. When had Confis become the rule he used to measure the cubits of his own heart?
Come, I Curie Zorias,
the Shrya of the Thousand Temples solemnly said, as though the gravity of what would ensue might forever mark their lives. And for a brief instant, Zorias grasped the gift of character that had hurtled this man to such heights, the ability to impart sanctity to the moment, to touch people with awe as though it were bread drawn from his own basket.
Come, listen to what I say to my people.
But over the course of this brief exchange, the sounds of thousands chanting Mathanet's name had transformed, hesitantly at first, but with greater certitude with each passing moment, changed into screams. Obviously, the nameless captain had executed his emperor's instructions with blessed alacrity. Zorias grinned his own winning grin. At last he felt a match for this obscenely imposing man.
Do you hear, Mathanet? Now they call out my name.
Indeed they do, the Shrya said darkly. Indeed they do.
Late summer, 4111, Year of the Tusk, Hinnereth, on the coast of Gedea. As though crowded by an antipathy to the sea, the land folded as it approached the broken coasts of Gedea. Since the coastal plains were narrow or non-existent, save the alluvial flatland surrounding Hinnereth, it seemed the land itself had conspired to bring the holy war to the ancient city. As the first cohorts descended the terraced hills, Hinnereth sprawled before them, huddled against the Menenor, a warren of mud and baked brick structures enclosed by sandstone fortifications. The mournful wail of horns pierced the salty air, rang from hill to sea, and pronounced the city's doom. Column after column wound down from the hills, the turbulent swordsmen of the Middle North, the long-skirted knights of Conraya and High Anon, the veteran infantrymen of the Nansurium. Hinnereth was an old prize. Like all lands falling between great competing civilizations, Gedea had been a perpetual tributary, little more than an anecdote in the chronicles of her conquerors. Hinnereth, her only city of note, had seen innumerable foreign governors, Shigeki, Kyrenian, Canaan, Nansur, and most recently, Kianin. And now the men of the Tusk would cut their names onto that list. The Holy War dispersed into several different camps around the fields and groves outside of Hinnereth's walls. After conferring, the great name sent an embassy of thanes and barons to the gates demanding unconditional surrender. When the Phanum of Ansaser Abzalashka, the Kianin Sapatashah of Gedea, chased them away with arrows and ballista, thousands were sent into the fields to harvest the wheat and millet secured the week previous by the advance forces of Earl Athgieri, Palatine Ingiaban, and Earl Werrigan Greatheart. Thousands more were sent into the hills to hew down trees for rams, towers, catapults, and mangonels. The siege of Hinnereth had begun. After a week of preparations, the men of the Tusk made their first assault. Clouds of arrows fell among them. Boiling oil poured down upon their mantlets. Men fell screaming from their ladders or were cut down on the battlements. Fiery pitch transformed their siege towers into soaring pyres. They bled and burned beneath the walls of Hinnereth, and the Phanum mocked them from the heights. In the wake of the disaster, some great name sent a delegation to the Scarlet Spires. Kefiramuni had already warned Saban and the others that the Scarlet Schoolmen, short of Shaima or a Kisharim attack, had no intention of assisting the men of the Tusk, so the decision was made to limit their demands. They asked for one breach in the walls, no more. Eleazarus's refusal was scathing, as was the condemnation of Proyas and Gotian, who had forsworn the use of blasphemy unless absolutely necessary. Another round of preparations followed. Some toiled in the hills, harvesting timber for more siege engines. Others hunched in the darkness of sappers' tunnels, dragging stone and sharp gravel out with blistered hands. Still others raised pyres of scrub and burned the dead. At night, they drank water carted down from the hills, ate bread, golden red clusters of figs, roasted quail and goose, and cursed Hinnereth. During this time, bands of Enrethi knights ranged south along the coasts, skirmishing with the remnants of Scaurus's host, plundering fishing villages, and sacking those walled towns that failed to immediately throw open their gates. Earl Athgieri struck inland, scouring the hills in search of battle and plunder. Near a small fortress called Deirut, he surprised a detachment of several thousand Kianin and put them to rout with as many hundred thanes and knights. Returning to the fortress, he forced the locals to build a small catapult, which he then used to lob severed Kianin heads into the fortress, one at a time. 131 heads later, the terrified garrison threw open the gates and prostrated themselves in the dust. Each of them was asked, "Do you repudiate Fane and accept Inri Sejanus as the true voice of the manifold god?" Those who answered no were immediately beheaded. Those who answered yes were bound with ropes and sent back to Hinnereth, where they were sold to the slavers who followed the holy war. Other strongholds likewise fell. Such was the general terror of the Iron Warriors, the old Nansur fortresses of Ibarra and Kurut, the half-ruined Canaan fortress of Gunsay, the Kianin citadel of Am-Amade, built when the populace had been still largely Enrethi, all of them like so many coins swept into the mailed fist of the Holy War. Gedea would fall, it seemed, as quickly as the Enrethi could ride. At Hinnereth, meanwhile, the great names had completed their preparations for a second assault, only to be awakened by shouts of astonishment. Men tumbled from their tents and pavilions. At first, most pointed to the great flotilla of war galleys and carracks anchored in the bay, hundreds of them bearing the black sun pennants of Nansur. But soon they all stared in disbelief at Hinnereth. The great forward gates of the city had been thrown open. All along the curtain walls, tiny figures pulled down the triangular banners of Ancacer, the infamous Black Gazelle, and raised the Black Sun of the Nansur Empire. Some cheered, others howled. Bands of half-naked horsemen could be seen galloping toward the towering gates, where they were halted by phalanxes of Nansur infantrymen. For a moment, swords flashed in the distance. But it was too late. Hinnereth had fallen, not to the Holy War, but to Emperor Aikuri Zorius III. At first, Aikuri Confis ignored the summons of the council, and the daunting task of placating Sauban and Gothyok fell to General Martimus. With the arrival of the Nansur fleet the previous night, he brusquely explained, the Gadean Sapatashah had seen the hopelessness of his position, and so sent Confis the terms of his surrender. Martimus even produced a letter, dark with the cursive script of the Kianine, which he claimed was in Ancacer's own hand. The Sapatashah, he asserted, was deeply frightened of the fervor of the Inrithi, and would surrender only to the Nansur. In matters of mercy, Martimus said, a known enemy was always more preferable than an unknown. It had been the first instinct of the Exalt General, he continued, to summon all the great names and present this letter for their appraisal, but Martimus himself had reminded the Exalt General that the proffered capitulation of one's enemy was always a delicate thing, the result perhaps of passing apprehension rather than real resolution. Accordingly, the Exalt General had decided to be decisive rather than democratic. When the great names demanded to know why, if Confis had truly acted in the interests of the Holy War, Hinnereth still remained closed to them, Martimus merely shrugged and informed them that those were the terms of the Sapatashah's surrender. Ancacer was a tender man, he said, and feared for the safety of his people. He had, moreover, great respect for the discipline of the Nansur. In the end, only Sauban refused to accept Martimus's explanation. Hinnereth was his by right, he bellowed, just spoils of his victory on the battle plain. When Confis finally arrived, the Galeoth prince had to be physically restrained. Afterward, Gothyelk and Proyas reminded him that Gadea was an empty and impoverished land. Let the emperor gloat over his first hollow prize, they said. The Holy War would continue its march south, and ancient Shygek, a land of legendary wealth, awaited them. Stay with me, Zin, Proyas called out. He dismissed the council only moments earlier. Now standing, he watched his people mill and make ready to leave. They filled the smoky interior of his pavilion, some pious, others mercenary, almost all of them proud to a fault. Gaedeki and Ingaiaban continued to argue, as they always did, over things material and immaterial. Most of the others began filing from the chamber. Ganyati, Kushigas, Imrothus, several high-ranking barons, and of course Kellis and Neyur. With the exception of the Skilvendi, they bowed one by one before vanishing through the blue silk curtains. Proyas acknowledged each with a curt nod. Soon, Zynemus was left standing alone. Slaves scurried through the surrounding gloom, gathering plates and sticky wine bowls, straightening rugs, and repositioning the myriad cushions.
Something troubles you, my prince,
the marshal asked. I just have several questions.
About?
Proyas hesitated. Why should a prince shrink from speaking of any man? About Kellis, he said. Zynemus raised his eyebrows.
He troubles you?
Proyas hooked a hand behind his neck, grimaced. In all honesty, Zin, he's the least troubling man I've ever known.
And that's what troubles you?
Many things troubled him, not the least of which was the recent disaster at Hinnereth. They'd been outmaneuvered by Confis and the Emperor. Never again. He had no time and little patience for these personal matters. Tell me, what do you make of him?
He terrifies me,
Zynemus said without an instant's hesitation. Proyas frowned. How so? The marshal's eyes unfocused, as though searching for some text written within.
I've spilled many bowls with him, he said hesitantly. I've broken much bread, and I cannot count the things he's shown me. Somehow, some way, his presence makes me better.
Proyas looked to the ground, to the interleaved wings embroidered across the carpet at his feet. He has that effect. He could feel Zynemus study him in his cursed way,
as though he saw past the fraudulent trappings of manhood to that sunken-chested boy who'd never left the training ground.
He's only a man, my prince. He says so himself. Besides, we're past...
How is it, Commian? Proyas asked abruptly. The stocky marshal scowled. He buried two fingers between the plaits of his beard to scratch his chin.
I thought his name was forbidden.
I merely ask. Zynemus nodded warily.
Well, very well, in fact. He's taken a woman, an old love of his from Sumna.
Yes. Esmenet, is it? The one who is a whore?
She's good for him, Zynemus said defensively. I've never seen him so content, so happy.
But you sound worried. Zynemus narrowed his eyes an instant, then sighed heavily.
I suppose I do, he said, looking past Proyas. For as long as I've known him, he's been a mandate schoolman, but now, I don't know.
He glanced up, matched his prince's gaze.
He's almost stopped speaking of the consort and his dreams altogether. You'd approve.
So he's in love, Proyas said, shaking his head.
Love,
he exclaimed incredulously.
Are you sure?
A grin overpowered him. Zynemus fairly cackled.
He's in love, all right. He's been stumbling after his pecker for weeks now.
Proyas laughed and looked to the ground. So he has one of those, does he? Akka in love. It seemed both impossible and strangely inevitable. Men like him need love. Men unlike me.
That he does. She seems exceedingly fond of it.
Proyas snorted. He is a sorcerer, after all. Zynemus's eyes slackened for an instant.
That he is.
There was a moment of awkward silence. Proyas sighed heavily. With any man other than Zynemus, these questions would have come naturally, without uncertainty or reservation. How could Zynemus, his beloved Zin, be so mulish about something so obvious to other men?
Does he still teach, Kellis?
Proyas asked.
Every day.
The marshal smiled wanly, as though at his own foolishness.
That's what this is about, isn't it? You want to believe Kellis is more, but... He was right about Sobon, Proyas exclaimed. Even in the details, Zin, the details! And yet, Zynemus continued, frowning at the interruption, he openly consorts with a Kamian, with a sorcerer.
Zynemus mockingly had spoken the word as other men spoke it, like a thing smeared in shit. Proyas turned to the table, poured himself a bowl of wine. It had tasted so sweet of late. So, what do you think? He asked.
I think Kellis simply sees what I see in Akka, and what you once saw. That a man's soul can be good apart from...
The tusk says, Proyas snapped. Burn them, for they are unclean. Burn them! How much more clarity can there be? Kellis consorts with an abomination, as do you!
The marshal was shaking his head.
I can't believe that.
Proyas fixed him with his gaze. Why did he feel so cold?
Then you cannot believe the tusk.
The marshal blanched, and for the first time the Kenryan prince saw fear on his old sword trainer's face. Fear. He wanted to apologize, to unsay what he'd said, but the cold was so unyielding, so true.
I simply go by the word.
If one couldn't trust the god's own voice, if one refused to listen, even for sentiment's sake, then everything became skepticism and scholarly disputation. Zynemus listened to his heart, and this was at once his strength and his weakness. The heart recited no scripture.
Well then, the marshal said thinly, you needn't worry about Kellis any more than you worry about me.
Proyas narrowed his eyes and nodded. There was constraint, there was direction, there was, most illuminating of all, a summoning together. Night had fallen, and Kellis sat alone upon a promontory, leaning against a solitary cedar. Drawn eastward by years of wind, the cedar's limbs swept across the starry heavens and forked downward. They seemed moored as though by strings to the panorama below. The encamped Holy War, Hinnereth behind her great belts of stone, and the Menenor, her distant rollers silvered by moonlight. But he saw none of this, not with his eyes. The promises and threats of what was came murmuring, and futures were discussed. There was a world, Iarwa, enslaved by history,
custom and animal hunger, a world driven by the hammers of what came before. There was a Kamian, and all he had uttered, the apocalypse, the lineages of emperors and kings, the houses and schools of the great factions, the panoply of warring nations. And there was sorcery, the gnosis, and the prospect of near limitless power. There was Esmanet, and slender thighs and piercing intellect. There was Sarcellus and the consult, and a wary truce born of enigma and hesitation. There was Sauban and torment pitched against lust for power. There was Neyur, and madness, and martial genius, and the growing threat of what he knew. There was the holy war, and faith, and hunger. And there was Father. What would you have me do? Possible worlds blew through him, fanning and branching into a canopy of glimpses. Nameless schoolmen climbing a steep, gravelly beach, a nipple pinched between fingers. A gasping climax, a severed head thrust against the burning sun, apparitions marching out of morning mist. A dead wife. Kellis exhaled, then breathed deep the bittersweet pinch of cedar, earth, and war. There was revelation.